Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick, and it's time for this week's review of the offense versus the Packers. I'll be flying solo in this one, so we'll probably be a little bit shorter than the normal. I have promises. The Ravens run wild over Green Bay. They won snap count dramatically, 74-44 in this game. So one of the few games this year that's happened, obviously, and it's still just the fifth time in 16 games. The Ravens have had 60-plus snaps, which is, to me, one of the really incredible and telling stats of this season, that the Ravens have been unable to generate snap count wins like they have before, or any kind of offensive consistency on a drive and series success basis, all reversed in this game. We'll spend plenty of time talking about that incredibly efficient performance by the offense in this one. They went 4 of 6 in the red zone, a good percentage. What's even better is getting there six times. So that's real good. 6 touchdowns and 2 field goals. Didn't turn the ball over in the red zone. Baltimore fans remember Super Bowl III. That's not the way it worked out on a regular basis when they got inside the red zone during that game. Packers, meanwhile, went just 1 for 2 in the red zone. They had some big plays to score their touchdowns from outside to get there to start with. The Ravens did not have big plays to speak of in this game other than the Henry runs. They didn't have a single pass over 13 yards, and they really relied on relentless Patton-like marching down the field in terms of driving a first down at a time on most of their drives. They moved the ball very effectively, of course, coming out. They took the possession rather than deferring when they won the toss, which is a little unusual. Harbaugh explained it as being a matter of the wind and wanting to have the wind in the fourth quarter after, obviously the Packers in the second half, as the rules go. And some people may not know this. You don't just automatically get the ball first in the second half if the other team takes the ball first in the first half. You have to demand that you get the ball first in the second half. You could decide the wind is more important in theory and not take the ball in the second half. But the Ravens knew they'd be forcing the Packers into that decision, and they'd hopefully have the wind at their advantage in the fourth quarter. It's kind of an interesting game management choice. Apparently the wind was less significant at the start of the game as well. So that was the explanation. A little bit unusual that teams do that, because you don't want to give up the two middle possessions. In theory, that can be a big inflection point in the game a lot of times. Wasn't a factor in this game. The Ravens only allowed the Packers one play and a kneel down at the end of the half. And then they came out in the second half, and they did score, as I recall. Let me make sure if I have that correct here. First drive of the second half, yeah, they just kicked a field goal. So they got down to the Baltimore 6, and that was where one of the really interesting defensive plays of the day. They used Trenton Simpson as a spy. He went out and tackled Malik Willis one of the few times they were able to contain him. I know a lot of people think, well, why didn't they know this so far? Why didn't they know that so far about this game in particular, the power run game, the continual use of Derrick Henry, all of the things they did to look more like the 2019 Ravens in this game. But actually going without a spy against Malik Willis was probably one of the things that was more harmful among all of the things they did. So when they did have one, Simpson came up with a very big play at the beginning of the second half, and the game could have been closer, could have taken a different path had they scored a touchdown on that particular Willis run or that set of downs anyway. Anyway, the Ravens, after they scored a touchdown the first drive, of course, the Packers scored on just two plays. They continued a horrible season of first drive defensive failures. There's an episode on that that's worth listening to. It's with Brandon Croxton, But effectively, the Ravens had at that point, and I'm not sure that that's improved enough since then, but they had at that point allowed opposing offenses to succeed at a rate that was higher than the 2007 New England Patriots in terms of points per drive on that first drive. Teams should not have that much trouble with scripted plays, I would say. Scripted plays in part, I know a lot of people think of it in my way, we got to be really successful on a scripted plays. Scripted plays are in part for probing the opponent and try to figure out how they're going to play you, how they're going to line up. And then, maybe you do have an advantage in some cases that you can throw some surprises out during those first 15 plays. But, you don't always succeed at it. And obviously defenses don't always succeed in reacting to what an offense is trying to do in an unusual way. And, it's a reasonable question to ask about your defensive coordinator is he finding ways to quickly adapt to what the opponent is doing? And that's something the Ravens have had some problems with this year. So the Ravens anyway, after that first drive, and it was a two-play mess. That was the pass down the left sideline for 39 yards where Wiggins had outstanding step-for-step coverage, had his arm out. The ball eluded his arm because he didn't find it in the air, a la Brandon Stevens. And Romeo Dobbs made the catch right down the right sideline for 39 yards. The very next play, 39 or 40, I don't remember the order of the actual plays, but the very next play, they threw it into the end zone. Or they didn't throw it in the end zone. They threw over Kyle Hamilton, who failed to drag the seam when there were four verticals on the play. So you had two safeties, each of whom had a responsibility for an outside vertical, and you had two down the middle who Roquan followed correctly, as they pointed out on the game. And Hamilton decided he'd give his off and pass it off to air. And that's, of course, exactly where Watson caught the ball for the easy six on either a 39 or 40-yard score on that second play. Looks like it was a 39-yard score, if you're keeping score at home anyway. That wasn't it for the Ravens, though. They came right back, scored their second touchdown on a nearly identical 13-play, 79-yard drive after a 75 and 74, actually, with the two distances on the drive. Each of those drives had six first downs, ended a touchdown, 13 plays, nearly identical. The Ravens, after two drives, were up 26-2 early in the second quarter in terms of snap count. They held the Packers to just 12 plays in that first half, largely through the efforts of the offense, but also the Packers' defense made some mistakes, and they scored quickly on some other cases. So the offense basically took control of snap count very early in this game and held on to that lead in the second half, but they didn't really extend it all that much. You look at what was different for the Ravens. I think the power run game being as successful as it was is probably at the heart of what was different about the Ravens offense in this game and what went on. They relied much less on zone. They did have no zone runs in this game. They had some, but you run the ball 53 times in one football game. You're going to use a mix of strategies, and they did that, but they ran a lot more power. So you saw a lot more duo blocking. You saw a lot more guards on the move. You're going to hear the totals for pulls and level two blocks are astounding from this game. It was truly one of the most impressive running performances in Ravens history, and there have been a lot. Think back to that 2009 AFC wildcard game against New England. They ran the ball 52 times in that game. That did include a three kneels, I believe. So maybe it's 49 times you want to talk about that time. That was the first time I ever saw somebody pull as much as Marshall Yanda did in that game, 19 times, and he hit on 15 in that game. That included a huge, it wasn't a pull, but it was a move to level two where he had a very nice inside stick on Vince Wilfork, who we saw then later explaining on the sidelines, and then turned to the right to block. I believe it was Guyton in level two, and that allowed Ray Rice to slip through for the 83-yard run. And they were off to the races in that game. They never stopped running the ball. Flacco only threw the ball 10 times that day, completed four, I believe, for 39 yards. The Ravens won that game handily, 33-14. And we got to listen to a lot of really whiny talk show chatter after that game in the car. I can tell you that's a lot of fun, by the way. Being in the opposing city, getting to listen to opposing local radio after a game like that is an awful lot of fun. I would have loved to listen to some of the Packer stuff afterwards. Although I think, you know, this game meant a lot less to the Packers than obviously a wild card playoff game meant to the Patriots in 2009, who consider themselves perennial contenders. But it was fun to listen to anyway. If you look at your other great games, go back 5 years, and a lot of you are you know, not too young to remember the 2020 finale when the Ravens won 38-3 at Cincinnati. There'd been a lot of chattery talk during the week by Jermaine Pratt in particular about how the Ravens were soft, they were this, they were that. The Ravens went in there and not only beat them 38-3, but rushed for 404 yards. The all-time record of the NFL is 426. So the Ravens were well within range, and they kind of let it slip away from them at the end of the game. And frankly, after the talk that occurred that week, I thought that would have been an appropriate time to steamroll them for the final yardage, run some of those outside pitch plays that might get you another big carry or another big run against a very tired defense. But Harbaugh didn't do it, and I guess he's a cooler head in that sense, prevailing, not caring about the record in that particular case. And letting that one get away. But this game right in that class, they rushed for 307, and then you think about the circumstances. They had Tyler Huntley at quarterback, starters. You're lacking the real misdirection elements of the Ravens' run game that they have with Lamar Jackson. So they relied much more on power in this one. They were fortunate, I would say, that Green Bay really chose not to crowd the line of scrimmage. So I don't think Huntley would necessarily do well with that. And I don't think he would do well with that if that's how the Steelers plan to do it next week. And we'll see how that goes. But anyway, the rushing game was continually successful and was helped by the fact the Packers had some injuries during the game. They lost a safety. They lost Riley off the line of scrimmage. I don't know how many defensive linemen they had active, but I know Brooks played an awful lot of snaps in this game. They seemed low in terms of bodies available to them to play defense there. And I think there's an element of hitting a cripple here that that's probably not a politically correct term anymore. That's a term that was around when I grew up. But you understand the meaning, I'm sure, if you're taking it in, but it's something that this is a badly banged up team and they took advantage of that. Nice to see them do it. Nice to see them do it effectively. If you look at Huntley's performance, I described him as flawlessly conservative. The ball was schemed out very quickly out of his hands. In particular, if you look at the results by play, and when we talk about his performance more specifically, we'll get into some of this detail, but a lot of 5 yard passes with a little bit of yak. He did not have a single completion over 10 yards in the air. He might have not had one of 10, like the longest might have been 9 in the air. It's either 9 or 9.5 or so. There's a plot diagram I've seen. He had 2 incomplete passes that were longer, but he didn't have any completed passes that were there. Didn't really incent in my opinion, the Packers to play any kind of a spread defense against him. He certainly, it's not the kind of performance and not the kind of scheme that the Ravens put on display for at least 53 of the 74 plays that would have said it would be fairly easy to collapse and focus on Henry with lots of 8-man boxes and take our chances on the outside, take our chances in man coverage and single up against some tight ends. Let some players drop later into shallow zone coverage. They really played a fairly standard looking defense the whole night. They didn't crowd the line of scrimmage a lot, and I think that really played to the Ravens' benefit. Offensive line, I thought, played extremely well. Now the offensive line was not without warts, and we've seen a number of offensive linemen who've missed blocks a lot this year. This is no different. Falele missed a bunch of blocks in this game. What I will say, though, is he had low-cost losses. I'm going to get into some of that later when we talk about the offensive line. And he had a lot of high-value wins. And in particular, The Ravens offensive line was not penalized. They did not give up a sack in the game. Huntley was sacked once for 0 yards. They didn't give up that sack. They did allow two quarterback hits, and they allowed some pressures. So the Huntley's opportunity set was not particularly good. But the offensive line played an outstanding game overall, and it was largely outstanding because of fantastic run blocking. And that was across the line. Every single player across the line really participated in that from left to right. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Really seems to have been one of the big wins. Going back to the power scheme, brought out some of the best of some of the other players. I thought both Linderbaum and Falele greatly improved by the presence of more duo blocking as opposed to zone. It's more natural for them. It's more natural for Linderbaum in a lot of ways to set up Falele, or the other way around sometimes. Sometimes he's the trailer. This is a game. Linderbaum was a moving, climbing terror in level two. So that was very exciting. We'll talk about that in the second part. But we got through Saturday night. It was a long but happy night that ended, you know, for sure, really with the Willis injury, but two plays later with the Humphrey interception, if there was any doubt left, when Clayton Toon threw a ball that was off the hands of Melton, popped up, and Humphrey made a great play on the ball. That it really ended the game. And we then had Sunday to worry about, a 1 o'clock game with the Steelers and Browns. If you're like me, you stayed up late, you pondered whatever. They got up and the Steelers are almost ready to play already. And that game was just a wonderful swelling of good feeling from the beginning with the fact that the Browns scored, went up 10-0 on the first two drives. Shedeur Sanders looked like he had something going in that first half with 175 yards passing or thereabouts in that first half. They ran the ball a little bit effective. The guy who was doing it was Raheem Sanders, who held the distinction of being the only running back that was claimed off the final cuts in August, or in early September, I guess it would be, across the entire NFL. So it's the biggest waiver claim process of the year that you have to go through at that point. A lot of players get claimed. The Ravens, of course, had Jalen Armour Davis and some other guys claimed off their roster. I think they had three total claims made against them. And they lost three other guys to signings by other teams' practice squads. But Raheem Sanders was the only running back in the entire league who was cut and signed by someone else. So an unusual situation indeed, and he's played well. He's done some things well for Cleveland, including, I thought, playing reasonably well in that first half against the Steelers. So we got to watch a 13-6 game, the enormous fourth down stop that we believed ended it at the 20-yard line. Then the Browns chose to take the most conservative role possible, which wasn't quite kneel kick, but it was run kick. Fortunately, Schmidt made the kick. Things might have been very much scarier otherwise. The Steelers would have still needed a touchdown, but they went up 13-6. The Steelers drove right down the field, and it was interesting, and this is something that we probably should be concerned about for next week. After the loss of Washington earlier in the game to a broken arm, who'll be an enormous loss against the Ravens, an absolutely enormous loss. All of a sudden, Aaron Rodgers found Pat Freiermuth again. Pat Freiermuth has been the forgotten man in Pittsburgh this season. He's hardly touched the ball. And I had to look up how many targets and catches he's got this year. But I know it's way less than what you would expect for him at this point in the season. So he has still 38 receptions on 49 targets. And barely a 50% success rate, which is, it's not terrible. Good catch rate for what he's got. He's still averaging 9 yards per target. But the problem is that Rodgers, it's like he found his game against the Ravens the first time in terms of his ability to drop the ball in the bucket with the ball being out quickly still. So throw the ball to a spot, let your receiver run under it. If the Ravens are playing single high coverage, he was good throwing outside the numbers, and he did some things that he hadn't done in a month prior to that game. and unfortunately found Pat Freiermuth again on that final drive with a minute and 40 to go, I believe. And they drive down the field like a knife through butter. And Pat Freiermuth, a couple of big catches, got him down to, what, about the six-yard line. Looked like they were going to tie the game up. And then I had the fear of, are they going to go for two and win the game or lose the game right away? You know, the Ravens' whole season could be on a play, or it could be they would go to overtime. And, of course, then, I didn't really have any confidence on the Browns driving for a score in overtime. So, just not a good situation overall. And then, amazingly, the Browns were able to get off the field on four downs. Myles Garrett never did get his sack, but it was just a wonderful day as a Christmas miracle in a way, coming a couple days late to give this Ravens this next chance. And they'll be playing now on Sunday night for the AFC North title. Ravens opened as -3 on the road. Last I looked, it was -3.5, but that's worth another check right now because there's definitely been drift in terms of the Ravens, towards the Ravens, in the last day. So right now I'm looking at it, it's still 156 and 265 in decimal format, which is the same place it was earlier when I looked at it. And just to give you an idea, the implied odds of the Ravens winning the game, about 62.9%, according to the gambling public. Most other things I've seen, most other simulation methodologies would have it as less than that, maybe 55%. DVOA has the Ravens at like 40% to win this game. So it's there are certainly a lot of different methods out there to factor out how they, who has the better chance to win the game. Gambling markets are usually quite efficient in this manner. They're not count of idiots weighted. They're money weighted. So if count of idiots starts to drive the line in a certain way, then sharps move in. And if the line is significant enough in terms of the difference, they'll adjust it back to where it ought to be. So I think that, probably 60% is closer to the Ravens' true chance of winning this game, which is it's a nice feeling to be going in there. And maybe the Ravens would like to be the dog now after winning the two games as a dog, after losing the two games they needed to before the week before, when the Steelers were an underdog of the Lions and the Ravens were a favorite over the Patriots. Maybe they'd like to be the underdog again, but anyway, they go in and they face a very banged up Steelers team. We'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit at the end of the episode, but Metcalf will not be available. Calvin Austin may or may not be available. We may have better opportunity, better idea of that this week. I don't expect that Darnell Washington is going to be available after breaking his arm. I really don't know how he could be. So I'd expect that to be a season-ending injury. And that is the big three receiving weapons for Aaron Rodgers. So be my guess that we see Pat Freiermuth and get a heavy dose of him. And I imagine Kyle Hamilton is going to be the man most responsible for that coverage. So anyway, let's move on. The Ravens did some great things in this game. They went 10 of 14 on third down as one of the really recognizable things. They did extremely well. By the way, one of those third downs that they failed on, they then converted on fourth down with the NZI penalty that pretty much it seemed like everybody on both sides of the line of scrimmage was lined up offsides, or, four people for each team kind of thing. And the one of the Packers moved a little bit more in the neutral zone, and Linderbaum touched up, therefore forcing the decision. It's interesting one that Linderbaum did it, because you'll see oftentimes the center will move around and he'll point and he'll change protections and whatnot. So he's allowed to move his hand as long as he doesn't move his feet, as long as he doesn't move the ball. And it's interesting. I mean, by touching up, he may have created a free option for the Ravens to get the flag called without initiating a flag himself. And I don't know the actual rule on that, but it was an interesting move there, and a savvy move from Linderbaum. And of course they blew the whistle right away, and they threw it because the guys on the side had seen the jump, and the neutral zone infraction was called. The Ravens got the first down. It was a very big one there at the end of the game. They rolled up 30 first downs for the game. To give you an idea of how significant that is, the Ravens have had only 10 times in their history they've had 30-plus first downs. Most of those have been exactly 30. I think it might have been either 4 or 6 of the total times it's happened. It's been exactly 30 first downs. Let me see if I still have that up here. Yeah, I do. Okay, so yeah, 4 of the times it's been 30 exactly. They've had 31 four times also. They've had 32 once, and they had 36 in the 34-31 overtime win over Minnesota in 2021. Game I don't really remember. 34-31 in overtime versus Minnesota. So was that in Baltimore? I'm trying to remember that ball game, and I'm having a hard time doing it. But anyway, needless to say, every time they've had 30, well, not needless to say, but every time they've had 30 or more first downs, they've won the game. They won the Rams game 45-6. They won the 2019 Miami game 59-10. Those were both in that group. They won the Chiefs game in 21. If you remember the one they went for it on fourth down, they won that game 36-35. The Chiefs game in 2009, the season opener, which was close until about 2 minutes left in the game, they won 38-24. So they've had a good record, and they should when they get that many first downs in a game. The other thing that was really remarkable about this game was the efficiency on a by-series basis. So let me describe exactly what I'm talking about here. The Ravens had 34 first downs in this game, 34 times where they ran a first down play. All right. Now, of those plays, I want to make sure I have my list here. Those plays resulted in 25 subsequent first downs. So they got a first down on 25 of the 34 series. Five were touchdowns, and the 25 first downs, I should be careful, they're non-touchdown first downs. So they got 30 first downs, you can see between those two, and you'd expect that to be the total. Then they had two field goals they kicked. Obviously, that's not a winning proposition. They were stopped both times in the red zone to kick those field goals. They punted once during the game, and then they knelt for the end of game. So a victory formation is certainly not a loss in that case. So it really, the denominator becomes 33, and they had 30 of 33 in series success, or 91%, which is ridiculously good. I can't remember the last time I've seen a number that high. I've seen teams score every possession in a game, but that's ridiculously successful in terms of having only three times that you fail to get a first down on a series of downs where you're not kneeling. The Packers simply could not get them off the field. They reminded me in a lot of ways of the 2019 Ravens, who had that sort of efficiency. Not at that level, but they led the NFL, and I believe it was 79% for the season in efficiency. They call it drive success rate, which is misleading. I wish they called it series success rate, because that's really what it is, a series of downs. But that chance to get a first down or a touchdown off any given first down was 79% that year. They're very much plugged into a lower variance style of play. I talk about this often, but let's be careful about what I mean by that. I think they probably had a lower average yards per play than they've had for the season as a whole. Let's check that out, because they ran for 5-point-something yards per carry. It doesn't seem reasonable, but then they had that for all their plays. So the Ravens actually only gained 5.1 yards per play. You don't win necessarily with only 5.1 yards per play. I'm sorry, that's per pass play. Let me get this right. Average gain per rush play was 5.8. The average gain per offensive play was 5.6. You still don't win every game that you have 5.6 yards per play. Just ask the Packers, who averaged 8.3 yards per play in this game. But what the Ravens did is they had incredible efficiency in terms of having many of those outcomes on a play-by-play basis peaked near that 5.6 yard average, such that they were able to reel off first down after first down in a thoroughly demoralizing fashion, I would imagine, for the Green Bay Packers. So ultra efficient series results. And I just got to wonder, coming out of this game, if the Ravens haven't kind of rediscovered who they are. Do I think Lamar Jackson is the right guy to unlock the best of this? Of course. But Tyler Huntley did a great job, and that gives me wonderful hope about, you know, what scheme-wise the Ravens might go to. It almost feels like they went to the power run game more out of a lack of choice, almost a lack of belief that the zone game would be as effective with the line of scrimmage more packed. And you know, if you're forced to play point of attack football, you want to play the power game. You want to get duo blocks in there, and you want to you know, have climbers that'll give you the best chance to pierce the defense at a point. Make use of Patrick Ricard there, as we've talked about many times before. That's exactly what the Ravens really did in this game. They played extremely heavy. We're certainly going to talk about that some later. They ran for 5.9 yards per carry when you exclude their one kneel, and 307 yards, or I guess we could call it 308 overall, which is an absurd number. Whenever you rush for 300 yards, that's very special. The Ravens have had a fair number of times they've done it during the Jackson era. They've probably done it, I don't know, close to 10 times by now during the Jackson era, but this is really special. This is a game they thoroughly dominated from start to finish, despite the fact Malik Willis was matching them for a while in terms of dangerous big play ability. And, you know, looked early in that third quarter when they got the score within 27-24, that they might really have the Ravens in a bad spot. But the Ravens had pulled away with two touchdowns with no answer for the Packers, and that was the way it ended. They rushed the ball 71.6% of the time, 53 rush and 21 pass. A very nice ratio, very rare to lose a game where you run over 60% of the time. Teams don't win because they run because they win. In this case, it was a little of both. Really was a little of both. The Ravens actually fueled their offense with an outstanding run game, and they also put the game away. And didn't. Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything: data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support, all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Didn't feel like they need to do anything but run the ball, because they were so successful at it and you know, did it so effectively when the Packers knew it was coming and couldn't do anything about it. So I watched a little bit of the Green Bay boards. You know, their run defense has not been terrible, and they basically were saying, I can't remember the last time we were this bad against the run. You know, one of the other Voice of Reason kind of posters there seemed to be talking about how after losing Riley, they were basically out of defensive linemen. And you know, hopefully the Ravens, somebody in their coaching booth is at least keeping track of opposing personnel and their remaining depth chart for the game in trying to figure out some strategy elements that ought to really work. You know, so-and-so 76 is very tired. Make sure we run at him on this play. And 76 has played 9 consecutive plays, or they haven't played anybody but these same two linemen for the same last 13 plays. You know, if you see that kind of trend occurring, where obviously the other team's out of players and they have to announce their current injury status as you go, then you know you want to take advantage of that. And I think the Ravens did a nice job of it in this game. Probably most important, the Ravens didn't turn the ball over in this game. The Packers turned it over twice. The one in the first half was a very big deal. The ball bouncing off Willis's face mask and recovered by Green really set the Ravens up not only with a short field, but actually interrupted a streak of successful drives by Malik Willis, which otherwise the game could have been very different. They might have actually taken the lead in the late in the third quarter had they not had that fumble earlier on. So I'm sure the game would have you know, could have taken a different route anyway. I guess let's talk a little bit about Tyler Huntley. And I'll talk about the rush against him for starters, because the Packers were very conservative in their rush. The Ravens were actually did a very similar job in this regard. They did not rush three any times. They rushed 14 times. They gave up 58 yards in the process, only 4.1 yards per pass. Most teams in the NFL, if they see a quarterback that's not doing anything against a four-man pass rush, they're not in a hurry to change anything, because the four-man pass rush is the easiest key to unlock winning defensive football. If you can rush the passer with four effectively, you pretty much are guaranteed to have an effective defense. With five men, they did rush that six times. They gave up 41 net yards, 6.8 yards per play, one sack. And then with six rushing, they had one play for 8 yards. Huntley got the ball out quickly. I think it's fair to say that it didn't really help them to rush additional people. It did help them at times to have extra in the secondary. We saw, the one time that Huntley really put the ball in jeopardy was in the left side of the end zone, where there were four bodies around, two Ravens, two Packers, and there was a nearly interception, maybe nearly a touchdown pass as well, but nearly an interception that would have ended that drive. They ended up kicking a field goal in the next play. But that was that was really the closest he came to putting the ball in jeopardy. That felt like there were other times when he was holding the ball a little funny, he was running with it, that could have gotten knocked out. But basically in terms of throwing the ball, that was the one time. Now here's where it comes in, and here's where Huntley's performance is more special than it really seemed, is in the results of ample time, space, ball out, quick, and pressure. The Ravens offensive line and skill position players, because they were part of it too, only gave him ample time and space on two occasions, as 10% of the time. Now, I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because some of it that is scheme and some of it is ability to actually protect Huntley. So my rule is that I won't call an ample time and space on a ball that's out in less than 3 seconds if I'm not sure that the ample time and space would have held up. So the bias is towards calling it ball out quick if the ball is out in 2.2, 2.3, 2.4 seconds. And the ball was out a lot early in this game. So that's going to negate the possibility of ample time and space opportunities. And there were only two in the whole game. So it probably, his protection was not good, as we're going to see in a moment, but that number might have also been whittled down a little bit by the fact that they were scheming the ball out of his hands so quickly. 2 of 2 complete for 9 yards with ample time and space of 4.5 yards per play. He got the ball out of his hand quickly on 8 of the 21 throws. That's 38%, on which he went 8 of 8 for 50 yards, 6.25 yards per play. This is the low variance Huntley at his best. Those ball out quick throws went for 6, 7, 7, 1, 5, 8, 6, and 10. Tell me if you couldn't maintain a few nice drives throwing for those kind of numbers, even if you're having to do it on third medium and set up some play. So the Ravens, did a very good job getting that. They had, by the way, some outstanding plays from their receivers made to extend the ball with high awareness of the line. In fact, receivers and runners, let's include everybody right now. But the very first drive, Andrews reached for the first down. We had Flowers reaching across for a touchdown, something has not worked out as well for him as we would have hoped in the past, but in this case it did. And that was in a lot of ways one of the biggest scores of the game. I put him back up 10, I believe, at that point. They had a run by Huntley late in the game that was actually challenged by LaFleur, where he reached the ball forward over the first down line, but it was a last ditch use it or lose it challenge, and LaFleur tried and it was denied. I thought, by the way, that play should have been a confirmed. The call on the field is confirmed, not the ruling on the field stands. I'm sure most people listening to this know the difference between those two, but it was clearly the ball was over the line, and they should have just said so. And if there's anybody keeping track of confirmed, stands, or reversed, then they'd have the you know, they'd have the totals of people for that. But anyway, I thought that that was one that probably should have been. The other one is Huntley on, I forget if it's the first touchdown or the second touchdown. He had to twist into the end zone over the prostrate form of Falele, who was providing value there as a, I don't know what you call it, a lever or whatever, a stump for him to roll over. And of course, you're not down until your knee is down or your elbow is down or other multiple body parts are down. And he did a good job of being right there. And Henry did a great job of using that advantage and twisting, corkscrewing in for that score. All right, pressures. There were 11 pressures in the game. Remember, this is 11 out of 21. So that's a very high number of 52%, which he's pressured on. He completed, let's see, what do I have? I have an obviously incorrect number that I'm looking at in front of me, but he completed four passes. And now it's more than that. He completed six passes out of 10, also was sacked once for 0 yards. So, had a decent run with pressure. Those plays went for 48 yards, so 4.8 yards per play. There's nothing that's a good number for pressures, by the way, because 3.5 would be the bogey you'd be looking for. But it wasn't the kind of low variance outcomes that the Ravens were looking for to have some incomplete passes in there in particular. And that was where all four of the incomplete passes resided. Here's what I'd say about the pressure that made it more challenging for the offensive line to provide either a BOQ or an ATS. I'm very protective, as you probably know, of the cone in front of the quarterback. So the quarterback's got to have a clean area to throw within about 2 yards in the cone that faces the intended receiver and goes out 30 degrees in each direction. Huntley didn't always have that because from under center, he had some three-step drops, and from shotgun, he had some I'm not moving backwards snaps where he just is taking the snap, surveying the field, making a throw from that exact spot. That's much harder for the offensive line to protect that spot than it is on a 5 or 7 step drop. So Huntley, by doing that, is putting himself in a good position to plant his feet and immediately get rid of the throw, get rid of the football, make some on-time throws, which, as we know, are more a factor of Huntley's game than they are a factor of Lamar Jackson's game. Lamar, you're wasting Lamar if you make him make on-time throws. With Huntley, you're protecting Huntley by making him make on-time throws. So that you scheme the ball out of his hands is a way to protect him from his own lack of pocket awareness and the problems that can cause in terms of either fumbles or interceptions he may throw later, hits he'll take as he's throwing the ball that might cause trouble. All of those things you're protecting him from. But by having Huntley stand right there and deliver the football, which obviously was a schematic choice, they created issues where the cone was getting impeded and imperiled more than it would normally. And that was a little bit of a problem for Huntley in this game. So 11 pressures, and he averaged 4.8 on that. He ran the offensive line, by the way, out of one pressure, and that was for a nice conversion. I believe it was a six, might have been the run I talked about earlier where he extended over the line, but a 6-yard run on 3rd and 5 seems to be what I recall as being the one. Anyway, that pressure he ran Ronnie Stanley out of. Ronnie gave up a few pressures in this game, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But he outperformed his overall opportunity set by 3 yards, 107 to 104. Last week is 58 to 56. 0.2 yards above expectation last week, 0.1 yards per play above expectation this week. We are in the small ball era here. You know, this is, let's get a runner on, let's bunt him over to second, let's try and, you know, get him over to third somehow. Without having to expand it out, and then let's get him home on a sacrifice fly or whatever it might be. But there's a lot of small ball involved with the Huntley offense. It's just incredibly efficient small ball. And when you've got a small ball offense, like there are some of you who don't remember the 2019 Ravens. That 2019 Ravens was the most demoralizing thing an opponent could ever face because they just reel up, you know, three plays for 13 or 14 yards pretty much whenever they wanted to. They convert a lot on third down. If you stopped them on third down, that wasn't the end of it. They're going to go on fourth down, fourth and one, fourth and two. That was an automatic go. Fourth and three, fourth and four, depending on where they were on the field, they would try it too. And they were very, very successful that year at taking those chances. And then all of a sudden, at any point in time, Lamar Jackson might decide to beat you over the top for a big play. And he had plenty of those to go that season. It made that season magical. The Ravens averaged 3.08 points per drive, which at the time was the fifth highest total in NFL history. I think it's been passed since then, but it's fallen out of the top five. But it's still one of the really great performances by an offense, and still the greatest Ravens offense that there's ever been. Even the two Derrick Henry years and with Lamar Jackson have not reattained the 2019 heights, where the offense they created by Lamar with Roman and with Harbaugh's blessing of building the offense completely around a new quarterback was so effective, and the league hadn't seen it. And then the very next year, everyone is drafting against the Ravens to figure out how to stop it. And everybody else was trying to figure out how they could do it. So it's always one of the really flattering things when everybody tries to copy exactly what you've done in anything, business or sports or whatever it might be. All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the other scheme. We'll talk first of all about some of the running back usage. Henry had 48 snaps in this game, Mitchell 14, Ali 15, two in Pony. The one Pony I can remember was Mitchell and Ali, but they must have had a Mitchell and Henry in there as well at some point, or another Mitchell and Ali, but they had two Pony sets. The very first one with Mitchell and Ali, they sent Mitchell out wide left to effectively act as a wide receiver. I've seen that be something that's interesting and potentially effective. I've also seen it where Mitchell is in jet motion, and I think that's fairly effective in giving the true three-headed look to the opposing defense in terms of where the ball might be going that can get players moving in the wrong direction, which is one of the things that the Ravens it's the fuel that runs the Ravens offense when it's running at its top end, is that misdirection ability. Henry had his third consecutive good Yakko game. He was at 4.1 yards after contact per attempt. His missed tackle force number actually is fairly modest in this game. And it's weird to say that because he had six missed tackles forced. It was his second highest total of the year, but it was also 36 carries. So the 0.17 missed tackles forced is still well below his career normal norm. 6 over 36 is that's missed tackles forced per attempt. But he held on to the football, so that was nice. And he the tackles he broke, I'm going to say, are not the reason why he had the tremendously successful day. I think a lot of the reason why he had the tremendously successful day is the number of first contact L2 opportunities the Ravens gave him in this game. And so it was a very good game for that. And they ground out yards, and they got good level two blocks for him to get some additional yards. But they mostly it's they beat the Packers at the line of scrimmage, created holes. Henry exploited them. Didn't necessarily break tackles. He got tackled, but sometimes it was fall forward yards. And that yards after contact number of 4-point run really says a lot just about how effective that's been. Incredibly, Derrick Henry had an entire year where he had, I believe, over five. I don't entirely trust. I got to see the PFF numbers on this because PFF tends to be quite different in terms of yards after contact. But I'll read from them because that's the one I've been using for a lot of things. No, actually, it wasn't that high. Okay, so in 2018, he was at 4.21 yards per carry. In 2019, he was at 4.16 yards per carry. Those are the only two that were ahead of his game rate in this one in particular. But still, he's at 3.55 yards after contact per attempt, according to PFF this year. And he's had kind of a somewhat tough year of his yards before contact. And that really depends heavily on what source you use, but that yards before contact number has been a somewhat of a challenge for him this year at a minimum. What's really been not very good is his missed tackle forced rate, which is 0.136 now for the year, 0.14 in his rookie season when he's still a hell of a player, by the way.
His rookie season was his lowest. And that year, as a rookie, believe it or not, Derrick Henry had only 2.6 yards after contact per attempt, which is more than half a yard lower than at any other time during his career. So that missed tackle force rate is important. The Ravens have found some ways to mitigate it this year, and Henry himself has had some long runs that have offset it some. He's not having his best year. He's certainly not having as good as last year. And yet, even right now, as he has one of his great career games again and writes himself into the history books in a number of ways that I'm sure you caught on the broadcast, he's back in a three-horse race for the NFL rushing title again right now. He's about 60 yards behind Cook, and there's somebody else in between who's in second place. But it's a three-horse race, and it would not be incredible, particularly since Buffalo, I don't believe, is really playing for anything in this final week. They may want to avoid the 7 seed somehow, and so not want to lose a game. But I don't imagine they're going to lean on James Cook too heavily in this final game. They're going to want to keep him fresh for the playoffs. And if they decided that they're going to hold back a little bit, then, well, it's very possible Derrick Henry, who the Ravens will certifiably need to beat Pittsburgh, has another big game and threatens to lead the league in rushing again. All right. No questions about usage in this game as the game wound down, I guess. Reportedly, there were things that occurred in the locker room after the game against New England that the Ravens really felt like, a lot of the Ravens felt, and Henry probably felt like he should have had the football in that next to last drive in week 16. The Ravens ran it down to about 5 minutes, but they didn't get the additional first downs they needed to put New England away at that point. And Henry felt like he should have been on the field. His last carry came with 12-something to go when he scored his last touchdown. And reportedly, he was pretty upset about that. And one of the things that contributes to the validity, what am I saying, it points to the validity of that theory, is that it took Harbaugh a long time to come out and face the media that night. So something was going on in the locker room, something where there had to be some hand-holding, some talking, some whatever, before Harbaugh was able to come out and face the media about that loss to the Patriots. So, there were tough questions for John as well in terms of, is your job gone? Do you have job security? Blah, blah, blah. So I'm not saying he wasn't trying to prepare himself for that or being spending time with Chad Steele, trying to figure out what the questions were likely to be and what the responses ought to be. There's a lot of that, by the way. That happens even in camp. Chad Steele talks to John Harbaugh before he comes to the podium about what the media is talking about, what questions they may have. And, he tries to be as prepared as he can as he comes to the microphone. All right. I don't see any reason why this group would not be better than Lamar. Probably, hopefully some of the same power schemes could be taken into Pittsburgh, and they would, I would bet, look more like the Greg Roman offense than the Todd Monken offense in some ways in a game like this, where they may well have a chance to win it on the ground. They need to be able to threaten to win it in the air in order to win it on the ground. But they have some history of beating the Steelers up on the ground pretty badly, including the playoff game last year in Baltimore, where they rushed for 299 to 29. So they've got a way to win it. I think they've got a formula they want to try and win it by. But a lot of that's going to depend on Lamar Jackson being able to prevent crowding in the line of scrimmage, to be back and be able to threaten to throw the ball over the middle or throw the ball to some empty grass when the Steelers are up front and choking the life out of the Ravens' misdirection opportunities. I did see in the last game that Lamar played, he had and this is against the Bengals, had the 30-yard touchdown pass to Ali and a nice throw to Hopkins for 32 yards that were both products of a crowded line of scrimmage. That helped uncrowd the line of scrimmage pretty decidedly in that game. And the Cincinnati really backed off in part due to those two plays. I think they came on the same drive, in fact, to score a touchdown early, and the Ravens were able to play more of their normal style of offense. And the Ravens are going to face some 8-man boxes, and they're going to have to run into some 8-man boxes when they get it. And they can still do it with good point of attack football and Derrick Henry breaking a tackle occasionally. But it's more difficult. And when they get to the line of scrimmage with that, you know, I really trust Lamar Jackson to check out of a play into something else he likes better, or to use the read option to find a back door that might provide a better opportunity than what Derrick Henry can do on a defense that's completely collapsing on him. So you got to have other options at the line of scrimmage, whether it's pre-snap or post-snap, in order to take advantage of a defense that's crowding. I thought this would be a little fun. I got two running backs for you I want to talk about. Running back number one has 612 carries, 3,390 yards, 5.5 yards per carry, 32 touchdowns, and 56.7% as a success rate. Now, success rate, we've talked about on the show a little bit in terms of it being the percentage of the time, and each play is marked a 1 or a 0. It's a 1 if you keep your team up with the sticks by a given set of requirements of percentage of the yards needed by down. So on first down, you have to gain, it's either 40 or 45%, depending on whose system you're using. And on second down, it's either 60 or 70%, depending on whose system you're using. On third down or fourth down, you have to get 100% of the required yards or you don't have a success. Anyway, that first player, you might have gotten from the 32 touchdowns, you might have gotten from the 5.5 yards per carry, but that first running back there is Derrick Henry in his 2 years in Baltimore. So been a remarkable couple of years. He's got 3,390 yards and counting with a game to go. So he's averaging, you know, well over 1,700 yards per season since he's been here with all those touchdowns and that high success rate. Running back number two, 699 attempts, 3,395 yards. So 5 more yards in 87 more attempts. So the yards per carry is down a little bit to 4.9 yards per carry. But he had 26 TDs and a 57.4% success rate. Very similar statistics in aggregate. Very similar statistics in aggregate. The second one is Gus Edwards' career in Baltimore. Now, I'm not trying to make a point that Gus Edwards is as good a running back as Derrick Henry. I don't believe that, and you shouldn't either. But what I will say is that it's pretty clear that Lamar Jackson has improved every running back he's ever played with, and Gus Edwards was among those. And in a sense, the fact that Derrick Henry is down a tick this year at 54.4% from the 58.8% he was last year, which is one of the highest figures of all time for a 300-carry rusher, should really be looked at in the light that he's taken a lot of snaps from Cooper Rush and Tyler Huntley during this year. And he just cannot be expected to have that same success rate. In fact, his overall career success rate at Tennessee, I believe, is 49.3%. I'll confirm that really quickly because, hey, that's important to the story. We want to get the story right, right? Yeah, Derrick Henry career at Tennessee had a 49.3% success rate. Anyway, what Lamar does for each running back is very significant. I would expect that whoever they've got in the game, whether it's Mitchell or Henry, would expect to be even better with Lamar there than with Tyler Huntley. Perhaps not Tyler Huntley versus the Green Bay Packers and their banged up defense, but in general versus any given opponent. The Ravens went back to very heavy style of play here with 2.17 heavies per play. They haven't been that heavy. I don't believe the whole year. I believe the whole year previously 2.14 had been the highest. So 2.17 in this game. They really demonstrated that commitment to the run. And all I can say is this was Greg Roman's offense, folks. We're seeing it again, these short passes. I mean, it was even more restrictive in some ways than Greg Roman's offense, largely because you had Huntley in there and you know, the ball was being schemed out quickly, continuously. But this is almost like Greg Roman's 2022 offense when it was at its height of its heaviness of personnel. They used 5 two-man counters in this game. That's a good indication the Ravens are getting the misdirection they want out of the power game. Ton of pulls in total. So the two-man pulls are just a subset of the total pulls. You're going to hear that in the second part of the show, that the offensive line did a remarkable job pulling, whether it was one or two. Huntley himself did not throw a lot of chain beating throws. He had, you know, the receivers and Andrews, Flowers. He had himself as a runner. He had, Henry as a runner, picked those up by reaching out over the goal line or over the chains to get there. Now, the last thing I'll talk about is they used a paucity of set and chip blockers in this game, 4 set and 13 chip. To go through a whole game with 4 set blocks is pretty good. It's telling the other team's not really going after you with numbers, which is, I think, a good thing for the Ravens and Huntley. 0.62 per pass or sack is what they used. That's a low number. Green Bay only used 4.4 pass rushers per play, so they weren't juicing it up the way, say, Minnesota did with 5.27 pass rushers per play. So it was a fairly Spartan rush that they showed. They had limited options in terms of what they could do. They also ran themselves into some very bad position when they rushed Huntley and two very successful quarterback draws right up the middle. They carbon copies of each other, two plays apart. And, you know, they got away with both of them, except they had an illegal formation on the second one that changed it from being a big gain to a 5-yard penalty. So it was a great game to watch. I mean, just if you didn't enjoy the Ravens running all over the opponent, you're probably just playing fantasy football or something, and you're upset with overall passing statistics, or that the Ravens there's some statistical value you're not liking about a Ravens receiver like Zay Flowers. Tough. You know, I think this is, if the Ravens have found this identity again, and if it persists in a way that is really meaningful, meaning, I think most importantly, I think Henry is who he is, and we've seen who he was in this game. I think he can be that again. I think it's really on the offensive line. Can they do this again to Derek Harmon and Cam Hayward of the Steelers on the interior? Can they keep Highsmith from ruining a game, whether or not Watt is back? Can they keep Highsmith from ruining a game from the blind side with Lamar Jackson back in? Can they keep the Steelers from doing effective things to either crowd the line of scrimmage or otherwise make it difficult for Lamar Jackson to win the game himself in whatever health condition he enters this game? I think a lot of it's going to come down to basically what can the offensive line, duplicate a performance like this? Can they maintain these outstanding duo schemes, power schemes, the good pulling impact that they had in this game? They weren't perfect on pulls, by the way. We'll get into that, but they were very good, and they made a lot of blocks in level two. They just showed outstanding mobility, and they beat the living snot out of them physically in this game, which was a lot of fun to watch. I think the Ravens are going to go on a big playoff run. Lamar Jackson coming back and being healthy is one potential key. I actually think it's the lower percentage chance. The big one, I think, is that the offensive line takes a big step forward and the Ravens lean into the power game in a way we just saw happen at Lambeau on Saturday night. Anyway, that's going to do it for the first episode. I'll be back to talk about a lot of things, the offensive line in part two. I want to thank everybody. Wish them a happy new year. You'll probably be listening to this on the 31st or maybe not, maybe on the 30th as well, but happy new year anyway. And it's been a great run here. We've had it, really enjoyed doing this show. We're not done with it by any stretch. Maureen's involved in the show now. One of the things she's doing is checking all social media, whether it's Instagram or Facebook, or now I'm more involved in Reddit, whether it's the Twitter, wherever it might be. We're trying to find questions. Use hashtag Film Study Mailbag if you can on Twitter. Otherwise, you can send me a question by email, even if you want it, filmstudy21@verizon.net. Particularly if I missed it for a couple of weeks and you feel, hey, Ken, why aren't you answering my question? Send it to me again by email. I'll include it in our question spreadsheet, which we just created today, by the way, that will help me organize things better and make sure people's questions get addressed. Because the worst thing you can do is you ask somebody a question that they asked you to ask and then you don't answer it. And that's, I'm planning on not doing that. So I appreciate you folks tremendously, and happy new year again to you. Be happy and be safe tomorrow night. And wish you the best. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.